Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program, the whys and the wherefores of the week that was, the magic number in the minimum wage fight, and the shocking truth behind nacho cheese. You will not want to miss that, believe me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 30th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And we are going to get right to it. Four lightning quick minutes in which the week in the global economy is dissected and explained. Here to do it are Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Sudeep, you go first. I want to talk about the GDP number out today, 2.6% last quarter, 2.5%-ish for the year. A little less than expected. Are you nervous?
I'm not necessarily nervous. We've been going through these GDP numbers the last few years that have been roughly the same when you average them out. So we're not getting the big economic liftoff, the escape velocity, all the things that we've been hoping for along the way. But, you know, considering the state of the world right now, it could be worse, and it could be worse. And you're seeing it all over the world that it is worse in most places in the world.
Well, yeah. So, Lynette, climb in here with the global economy.
I miss that word, escape velocity. Yeah. I feel like we kind of forgot about it as everyone kind of gave up hope and was like, can we just get some jobs here?
Well, right.
Everybody's going to wonder what this means for the Fed.
Yep.
You know, will the Fed decide to raise rates? Will it take this GDP number into account? I don't think that much has changed. I personally am in the camp that the Fed is not going to raise rates until wages increase. So to me, this doesn't make a huge difference.
All right. So we've got a thing on wages coming up in just a little bit. But since you brought it up, Lynette, let me put you on the spot. Are we still looking at this year for a rate increase from the Fed?
Some people say yes. Some people say no. Some people say mid-year. Morgan Stanley's gone ahead and said 2016.
Yeah.
I think that if the economy doesn't show signs of life soon, more analysts on Wall Street will be pushing their estimates back to forward to next year.
So we had an email exchange before we actually went on the radio, as we sometimes do, batting around ideas. And one of the things you mentioned was that Wall Street is sort of becoming of the opinion that the Fed might be out of options, that they're kind of stuck. Explain that a little bit.
Well, monetary policy can only go so far. You know, you need real, you need politicians to act. Maybe we could get some more long-lasting change to our economy, more boost tax increases or tax relief, or structural changes, maybe a little fiscal stimulus. I don't know. But, you know, what can the Fed do more than lower and raise rates? And some countries in Europe have negative rates. Everybody's like, well, what else can we do?
Sudeep, let me ask you, though, since Lynette brought it up, this idea of Washington and fiscal policy. The president's budget comes out on Monday. It's going to be, you know, posturing in this and that. Is there any chance, and I realize I'm asking for a 14th dimension here, that Congress and the White House agree on something economy-wise that is a positive?
There's a slight chance. There's always a slight chance. Never give up hope entirely.
There's
a reason they call budgets dead on arrival. And most of the policies that are going to be big in this budget have already been previewed. But you've already seen Republicans and Democrats at least indicate they're aligned on some areas like trade policy and maybe on corporate tax reform, which is really difficult to do in the first place. But at least they see that there is some opening. And I think the biggest difference now is that you have leadership in Congress that does want to prevent some of the serial crises that we've had. And the leaders on both sides do care about that. And obviously the White House does, too.
Let me dabble. Go ahead.
Sorry, Republicans seem like they want to look like they're getting something done. This Keystone Pipeline thing in the midst of lower gas prices, I think, is an attempt by the Republicans to make it look like they're doing something. But this isn't huge. This isn't mind-bending.
Exactly.
And that's what we need. We need mind-bending.
Let me take the last 19 and a half seconds that we have, according to my clock, and ask you guys, with the Mitt Romney news that he is not running today, does Wall Street line up behind Jeb Bush? Sudeep?
I think they will. There are a few other candidates they might line up behind, such as Chris Christie.
Chris Christie, yeah.
The names are out there, and it's pretty clear where they'll align. They're going to look for somebody who's going to potentially signal that they'll have a much more pro-business bent. But there are a number of people who might be able to do that.
Lynette, what do you think?
Some people like Marco Rubio, too. Some people don't like Chris Christie's attitude, and they don't love his record either. Right. I think Jeb will get most of the windfall from Romney. But also, people are talking about Scott Walker.
Right, out of Wisconsin, yeah.
It's wide open at this point.
Well, that's why they have the elections. That's why they play the game. All right, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good one, Kai.
You too. On Wall Street today, well, let's just say I personally am expecting the wah-wah trombones, but we all know that I don't get to pick, do I? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Lynette mentioned, now that the economy is steadily adding jobs, the big bugaboo in the labor market is wages, specifically stuck wages. That has been the through line for a couple of years now. But according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics this morning, specifically something called the Employment Cost Index, wages are growing, albeit, according to one economist, and this is a quote, grudgingly. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains why the Employment Cost Index is the wage indicator of choice.
The Employment Cost Index seems to be the darling indicator for many economists. That's true for folks at the Federal Reserve and for Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
If I were going to pick one measure to look at, it would be this one. This is giving us a pretty definitive read on what's going on in labor market with regard to wages and compensation.
Zandi likes the index because it gives a more consistent look at compensation over time. The Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys a rotating slate of firms on their employment costs. And unlike another measure of hourly wages, the numbers from the index don't get skewed as much by shifts in employment into, say, low-wage industries or occupations. What's the index telling us today?
Wage growth now is above the rate of inflation, ever so slightly so, but, you know, I'll take it.
Wages, salaries, and benefits grew at an annual rate of 2.2% in 2014. That's slower than pre-recessionary times, but the rate is picking up as the available pool of workers shrinks and employers have to start spending more to get new workers in the door.
A year from now, 2 years from now, if everything kind of sticks to script, I think workers will be getting even bigger pay increases, but obviously that's still a forecast.
Employers' benefit costs have also been ticking up. They grew faster last year than wages and salaries. Princeton University economist Alan Krueger says that breaks with recent trends.
We had seen healthcare costs growing so slowly, really exceptionally slowly compared to the history of healthcare cost growth, that benefits were not growing faster than wages until recently.
But it's unclear how long that situation will last as many employers shift more of their healthcare costs onto workers. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Out of the Commerce Department this morning came what is quite possibly a key indicator of a looming and big change in the American economy. Home ownership is at its lowest level in 20 years. No small thing in a country where having a place to call your own has been pretty much enshrined as the American dream. It's tempting to say that drop in ownership rates is bad news, but as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, maybe it's really not.
Fewer than 64% of Americans own their own home, a level not seen since 1994. It's almost like 20 years of progress just up and vanished. Well, that's not really the case.
We just have homeownership in our DNA, and that's why we're so focused on this figure.
Patrick Newport is a housing economist with IHS. He says that previous levels of homeownership were probably too high because of all the crazy loans that banks were offering, and homeownership is kind of a squishy measure of economic health anyway.
It's not bad news for the economy. It's a matter of who owns the paper, the title to the home that you live in. And what we're seeing now is a trend towards landlords owning that piece of paper, not the homeowner.
Newport says the rate may yet dip even farther, since many foreclosures have yet to work their way through the system. Another explanation for the dip in home ownership might be because there are just more households. And by household, I mean the government definition, meaning a person or couple living on their own.
Young people are, you know, going off on their own, getting out of their parents' basements.
Steve Fazzari is an economist at Washington University. He says household formation means people are getting jobs.
So if we have more households for that reason, that's really a signal of some good economic activity.
Fazzari says the real concern with housing should be construction and new housing starts, which are lagging and have been the key to every economic recovery since World War II. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
President Obama has been trying to get Congress to raise the federal minimum wage to just over $10 an hour. He hasn't had much luck, and in fact, the federal minimum has been at $7.25 an hour since 2009. It's a different story in cities and states where labor advocates have had more luck, thanks, quite possibly in part, to the lucky number 15, as in dollars per hour. From KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
Isn't this a good evening, sisters and brothers?
SeaTac, Washington is a tiny town just outside Seattle, home to the region's biggest airport. A year ago, it became the first city in America to have a $15 minimum wage, thanks largely to the efforts of union organizer David Rolfe. He addressed supporters at a victory party.
SeaTac will be viewed someday as the vanguard, as the place where the fight started.
That day is already here, but the funny thing is Rolfe never set out to raise SeaTac's minimum wage, much less start a national movement. He said his original goal was to unionize workers at SeaTac Airport. When employers led by Alaska Airlines played hardball, Rolfe put a $15 minimum wage proposition on the city ballot as leverage. It won by just 77 votes.
Things could have gone very differently. I think had the airlines said, we'll bargain a contract, those workers may have had $15, but it might never have been on the ballot. It would have been bargained into a union contract, and it would have just been for those workers.
As it turns out, because of a court challenge, it's actually those airport workers who are the only ones in SeaTac not making at least $15 an hour. But the $15 movement soon spread to Seattle last June and to San Francisco in November.
It was not yet with an eye on being some sort of domino that fell and leveraged similar victories across the country. Although I think people are very, very proud that that's what's happening.
And surprised, Peter Dreyer teaches politics at Occidental College.
A couple of years ago, the idea of a $15 minimum wage would have been considered outrageous.
So what changed? There's the 15 number itself, nice and round, easy to fit on a bumper sticker. The figure first came to people's attention in a series of strikes by fast food workers that started in 2012. The workers didn't achieve their goal of unionization, but $15 stuck. There's also the fact that post-recession, many voters have become more concerned about income inequality. Paul Sahn is the National Employment Law Project's general counsel.
It's pretty clearly a response to the economy's tilt towards low-wage jobs, which is hitting major cities like Los Angeles especially hard, since they're seeing wages flat or falling, but at the same time, housing and living costs are continuing to rise.
So how far will the $15 minimum wage spread? Unions are hopeful it can go to every state, but labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein is skeptical.
I don't think having high wages in a few cities is going to mean it's going to spread to essentially red state America.
Oklahoma recently banned any city from setting its own minimum wage, joining at least 12 other states with similar laws. In November, voters in four Republican-leaning states, Alaska, Arkansas, South Dakota, and Nebraska, did approve higher minimum wages, but they weren't close to $15. Lichtenstein says having a patchwork of local wage standards is bad for workers.
One of the laws of labor history is you can't have a strong labor movement in one place and the rest of the country being hostile to it. Eventually, the strength of that labor will be drained away as employers do, in fact, move.
Maybe. Whether local minimum wages cause businesses to pack up and move somewhere cheaper is hotly debated by economists. A UC Berkeley study predicted small clothing manufacturers could leave LA. But no one really knows, because the $15 wage movement has just gotten started. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They also said that they'd never heard of a specific definition of nacho cheese.
But wait, then what have I been putting on my chips? But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. See? The Wawa trombones. I say it and it happens. The Dow Industrial's off 251 points today, 1.4%. finished at 17,164. That is not actually the way it works around here, by the way. The NASDAQ down 48 points, 1%, 4635. The S&P 500 shed 26 points, 1.3%, finished things at 1994. For the week gone by, yeah, keep those wah-wahs going. The Dow off 2.8%. The S&P also down 2.8%. The NASDAQ down 2.6%. Amazon up 13.7%. Today, the online retailer posted a higher-than-expected profit in the fourth quarter. Google up 4.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up February 2nd. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for December. Let's spend some time in the pantry. February is National Canned Food Month. And just how much more winter are we in for? Should be addressed on Monday. It's Groundhog Day. Don't drive angry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. With apologies to Benjamin Franklin, in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes and the fact that doing your taxes is going to be painful, perhaps monetarily. Today's Exhibit A is TurboTax. The tax prep and filing software company raised its prices but didn't let users become aware of it until they tried to file said taxes. Sally Herships has more.
As if having to do your taxes isn't bad enough, imagine being told, you want to complete the process? First, you have to pay up.
We feel like they're almost taking us for a ride by saying, well, we have your information. We're not going to give it to you. We're not going to let you use it unless you pay us more money.
Jonah Berger teaches marketing at Wharton, and he says for TurboTax customers, it's not just about the money.
I think this is an issue of expectations. Consumers expected one thing. They thought they were getting the full product with paying a certain price, and they're actually only getting a piece of it.
So can TurboTax recover from this screw-up?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Brandon Cashin is global president of Addison Whitney, a brand strategy consulting firm. Luckily, he says, TurboTax has a strong reputation.
It's somewhat like Xerox photocopies. You know, it's, go Xerox that. Well, I'm going to do the TurboTax on my taxes this year.
Scott Galloway teaches marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. He says what TurboTax does now is more important than the mistake it just made.
The biggest PR crises in history haven't been a function of what happened, but how the company reacted.
Galloway says when a company screws up, three things need to happen.
To basically admit that you made a mistake. The second is to have the top guy or gal make that admission. And then the third is to overcorrect, and that is to offer consumers a better deal than they originally had.
Galloway says most of the time companies ignore these rules. TurboTax didn't respond to a request for comment, but its CEO has posted an apology on his LinkedIn page, and the company is offering a refund of $25. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There is, in Georgetown, in Washington, D.C., a supermarket which has come over time to be called the Social Safeway. More socializing than shopping, one gathers. Same kind of thing happens in other neighborhoods. Stores just get reputations. But a Kroger in Atlanta is hoping to change a rather ominous nickname that's been around for more than a decade. WABE's Michelle Alloy has the rebranding story.
Atlanta has a long tradition of naming its Kroger grocery stores. There's Disco Kroger because the store actually used to be a disco club. Hipster Kroger because it's in a trendy neighborhood and has a sizable organic section. Also Kosher Kroger because of its ties to the Jewish community. And then there's
the Murder Kroger.
Murder Kroger.
The Scary Kroger.
Likely named after a woman was shot and killed in the parking lot back in the early 90s. The store even inspired a song by the local band Attractive 80s Women.
It's a grocery store with a deadly twist. You get shot in the head for your shopping list. Murder Kroger.
We prefer our store called Beltline Kroger.
Glenn Jenkins is spokesperson for Kroger's Atlanta division. Recently, the Kroger in question held what it called a grand reopening to highlight some renovations.
We've made changes that include a bicycle pedestrian ramp that connects directly to the Beltline. There's new landscaping, new curbs and sidewalks.
Jenkins is talking about the Atlanta Beltline, a project that's turning old train lines to walking trails and eventually light rail that'll connect the sprawling city like never before. The Kroger is right next to it. And who wouldn't want to be associated with the Beltline? Project officials say since 2005, the Beltline has netted the city more than $1 billion in new private developments along the trails. And with it has come a new clientele near the Kroger, one that can afford $1,300 rents for a small studio apartment. But to Mac Williams, who wrote the song Murder Kroger, you don't get to choose a nickname.
It's just like if you're in junior high and you have a nickname you don't like, and you try and give yourself another nickname, like none of your friends are going to call you by the new nickname that you came up with that you like.
Walking along the Beltline right by the grocery store, residents seemed more optimistic, pointing to the luxury apartments and new stores that have sprung up along the trail. Lisa Bengoa used to live by the grocery store and says she never felt safe walking near it.
So I guess if the community changes and the patrons change, I'm hoping for the best.
Manon Herzog is a brand specialist with Davis Brand Capital, which is headquartered in Atlanta.
You cannot just make the decision to call it something else and it will all go away. You will actually have to back it up with actions as well.
Herzog says it all depends on how the neighborhood develops and that Kroger's taken a good first step by trying to align itself with the Beltline. Whether or not the name change does stick, Atlantans will still have the song to hold on to. In Atlanta, I'm Michelle Aloy for Marketplace.
The Food and Drug Administration has official definitions for more than 70 cheeses. Cheddar, Blue, Brick, they've all got very specific requirements they have to meet in order to be called what they are called. Not there is nacho cheese, because as it happens, nacho cheese might not really exist. Vanessa Wong from Bloomberg Business has a story up on Bloomberg.com, the title of which is There's No Such Thing as Nacho Cheese. Vanessa, good to have you with us.
Hey, Kai. Glad to be here.
I don't want to cast aspersions on your article, but what do you mean there is no such thing as nacho cheese?
I know. I'm really hurt, too.
So what happened? You went in search of, basically.
Well, yeah. So this story kind of started when I was writing about old El Paso's new nacho cheese blasted taco shells.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of a routine interview, and I asked them what it tasted like, and they were like, it tastes delicious. And I was like, but really, guys, what does it taste like? And they were like, well, it has this big, bold cheese taste. And I couldn't get a straight answer. And, you know, they told me it's like some combination of color and spicy and salty and, you know.
And that was basically
That was very unsatisfying. So I took my question to a couple of cheese experts, yeah, such as the manager of cheese education and training at the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board.
And those guys should know, right?
They should totally know. And she tells me that, quote, there really is not a nacho cheese per se.
Wow. And you talk to the International Dairy Foods Association, same deal. They said, yeah, no, we don't know.
Yeah, they were like, there's no standard definition of nacho cheese. And they both referred me to the FDA because they would come up with the definition for any cheeses for labeling purposes.
Did you eventually go to the Doritos people? Because, I mean, the reason nacho cheese is in the zeitgeist, right, is because it's that nacho cheese Doritos thing.
Oh, yeah. So the Doritos folks say that, you know, they use some blend of cheddar and Romano cheeses, but they also said that they'd never heard of a specific definition of nacho cheese. So Then I looked at other processed goods packaged snacks, yeah, I should call it that. And, you know, the old El Paso nacho cheese blasted taco shells, right, used cheddar and blue cheese, and Pringles used cheddar, Romano and Parmesan. So this guy at Old El Paso tells me, yeah, it's really based on what consumers are used to and what they believe nacho cheese flavoring is.
Wow, that's very zen, right? The whole it is what you want it to be.
It's just anything you want it to be.
See the cheese you want it to be.
Which is like, do you want that responsibility?
Yeah. And also, no, but I'm still going to eat nachos. Do a little history of this thing for me. You went back and you discovered sort of the roots of nacho cheese, such as it was.
That's right. So there was a story in the San Antonio Express News about a man named Ignacio Anaya, and his nickname is Nacho, thus the name.
Yeah.
And he invented nacho cheese, the legend goes, in 1943 in Mexico. And the story is that he used, quote, Wisconsin cheese, the round one. So based on this story, the original nacho cheese is cheddar.
So it's basically cheddar with a bunch of spices.
I mean,
come on.
If that's how you
if that's
feel,
what
God, I think you're entitled. Call it whatever you want.
Vanessa Wong at Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that this Sunday is Super Bowl XLIX. That is 49, of course, in the numerology the NFL has followed since 1971 and Super Bowl V. Not so next year, though, as we told you this past summer when the announcement was made, but we're re-upping it because this Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday. Super Bowl 50 will officially be Super Bowl 50, not Super Bowl L. The league's declared reason is that L by itself isn't pleasing to the eye. My declared reason is that maybe L is just for loser. I don't know. What do you think? All right, on a Friday, we are out of here. The Dow off 251 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ dropped 48 points. That is 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 26 points, 1.33%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.